We're going to have a panel of people from Lockridge, and then Phil's going to tell his story, something of his story, and then I'll give something of a biblical reflection. And Tanya's coming. And all right, is that? I think, as I think about it, I think Phil would be good to go after the panel. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so the questions that I have, it's sort of weird. I'm on the panel and yet I'm facilitating, so it'll be fun. So the questions I have are, what do we do in Lockridge? Why do we do it, first up? And then we'll go through the panel and ask that question. And the second question I have is, what are some of the highs and lows of living in Lockridge and doing community stuff? And then if you've got any questions of us, you can shoot them. And then Phil will tell his story. How's that? Erica, why do you do what you do in Lockridge? Why do you do what you do in Lockridge, and what do you do? Or what's some of the stuff that you do?
That's an nice question. Sorry.
Why?
Let me start by saying the stuff that I knew I had to talk about, and I'll see if I can pick up something interesting. Samuel really likes to go to the car, apparently. So we'll see if we can get him to stay in the car. One of the things that we are quite passionate about as a community is doing what we can, I guess, to redeem creation, not just people, but creation. And we either are involved in or supportive of the community garden. And those of us who can, keen to grow as much food ourselves. We also, the garden has a permaculture program, so that's, and it's kind of a similar model to the community where someone gets their garden done, it's a permaculture design, and then a whole lot of people turn up on the day and do the work so that then they can grow things, and then those people then go and help at the next one. So we've had our garden done, and then we've provided labour for, you know, numerous other permaculturists and other people's houses. So it's, and you know, it's about a community of people coming together and getting a whole lot of work done in a short time. We haven't actually eaten any yet, but we're also trying to grow some free-range meat. Little bunnies.
You didn't have to mention that.
But it's something that we share as a community. So we've got some at our house, some at Tanya's, and some across the road at Peter. And it's not just open table. It's often some of the things we do, especially the garden stuff, is shared between open table and Peace Tree, and in part the Anglican Church. I probably wanted to be involved in this because I think I wanted to connect more with people. I see life as being, it's very easy to be busy and to just do what you've got to do and go through it without really connecting with people. And I wanted my kids to have the opportunity to have stronger connections with people. And it also, Steve and I have worked in this community for a long time, and it was really hard work doing that on our own, and we just wanted to see whether it was more sustainable, and I guess the load being a bit lighter if we shared that, and that's certainly been our experience. Yeah. I want to do highs and lows later.
Yeah, is that right? Tanya, what do you do? What do we do in Lockridge, and why do we do it? Why do you do it?
One of the things that we do in Lockridge is a place called Ezekiel House. That is a house that a group of people, not me because I don't have any, but a group of people put some money together and bought a house in Lockridge, which is actually right next door to the Peace Tree community. And that house is available for, it's a men's house, for people who find themselves either homeless or who want to stay in a supportive community themselves. So a number of different people have come in and stayed for different amounts of time in that house. We have and then support is provided to those people through people in our community. At the moment, we've recently had someone come and stay who we call a stable dweller, and just someone who can be a more stable presence for the guys who are in the house, who can be available to sit and chat and pray. And the theory is for the guys, once they get a bit more on their feet, to transition out of the house into their own accommodation or somewhere else. Steve has often had people suggested to him, hey, this person needs a house, or this person's staying in St. Bart's or somewhere, men's hostel in the city, can they come and stay at Ezekiel House for a while? Phil stayed at Ezekiel House for a while, and now he's living at our place. I've referred to him as my second husband a couple of times, which is nice and handy when I want the lawns mowed. And so Phil is in the house that we're renting at the moment. Has a shed out the back, and it's lined, and it's quite nice, it's quite spacious. And for it to be more ideal, we would have a toilet and a shower in there, so for whoever lives in that space could, you know, be totally independent in their own space.
Why do you do what you do? Why do you join us?
The first time I seriously thought I want to be a part of something like this is when I saw some photos through email. It was a young, it was a Maori guy who was killed in Lockridge, and there was a fight between Maori guys and Aboriginal guys. And the people who were involved in Lockridge at that time, Steve and Erica in the Peace Tree community, had a reconciliation service in the community garden. And I saw the photos of this reconciliation service with the mother of the boy who was killed and different people who were there, and the tree that they planted and the words that were said during this service. And I was really struck by these photos, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is the stuff that I want to be involved in. This is God's work, this is healing work, this is really important stuff, and I want to be involved in that. And when we were discussing the concept of community living, Gary and I were saying, absolutely no way, we're not moving. We've just moved to our nice 4x2 in Helena Valley, and we've only been there 7 months, and I'd like to retire here, it's quite nice. And we kept having discussions about getting together, about intentional community, and we said, we like you guys, we'll keep having discussions with you, but we're not moving. And then God thought that was really funny, and decided to let Gary and I know first that we thought that we should live in intentional community and that we should be in Lockridge. So everyone was a bit shocked. So it's to be involved in the good work. You know, it's stuff that I wouldn't have been able to be involved in Helena Valley, living by myself with my roller door going down. I wouldn't have met any Aboriginal people, and there just would have been no opportunity for heart to heart in the same kind of way.
That's great. Thank you. Gary, what's some of the stuff we do internally, and how did we, community of Lockridge Open Table, and how did that come about?
Well, we meet regularly. We've recently started praying each weekday for half an hour or 15 minutes in the morning. 6:30 to whatever. So there's that, which we do. Some of these things that you need to be very close by to be able to do. And we meet every second Sunday for a business type meeting and a bit of prayer and so on. And we have Monday night dinners together as well. But I was formulating my answer to the previous question, and I thought I was going to say, well, we could reverse that question and say, why does most of our society live in a suburb that's miles from family or friends or work or church and drive around a lot, and not get to know so much those in the local area. So it's taken a number of years for us to get within walking distance just because of the logistics of finding the house in the suburb available at the right time for the right price, etc. But with a few moves, we're now within walking distance, and we have that ability to to connect, and any person in the local area will connect with one of us and then realise that, oh, this one's connected with that one, and so it becomes a network that forms. I've got more to say, but I'll hand over and I'll come back to you, I suppose.
I was going to handball to Phil. One of the thoughts that we had about Ezekiel House was, we have something of like a spider's network, a community of support. How can we use that network of support, particularly for people who particularly need it and need a bit of a hand up, not just a handout? And so that's partly why we started Ezekiel House, for people coming out of either drug rehab or coming out of prison or coming out of crisis accommodation. How can we then... One of the problems is they don't tend to have a new network of stable, strong, straight and clean and dry friends. So that's why, partly why we started Ezekiel House. Can you tell us, Phil, of something of your background and something of how you came to connect with us?
Morning, guys. They say life begins at 40. I've recently turned 41. And my story, my journey has been a long, arduous one. And October last year, I was baptised and I became a Christian. Prior to that, I've lived most of my life outside the law, a bit of a reprobate. I've had some good things done in my life. I was a soldier for the Australian Regular Army for 6 years. Out of that 6 years, I saw 2 years active service in a war zone. That, at the time, as a young child, I sort of enjoyed doing what I was doing. It was adrenaline pumping stuff. But little did I know, many years later, that would have consequences I would end up carrying a heavy burden, and one that I still go to this day. After I left the army, I had a young family at the time, and I ended up finding myself involved in an outlaw motorcycle group. I had brothers that were involved in it, and ended up becoming as what you would know as a bikie. I was a bikie for 8 years, so you can just imagine the sort of lifestyle I've lived. Got involved in drugs, extortion, you know, there's not much I haven't done, and I don't say that lightly. And then my life just continued to skyrocket down and down and down, and I lost my family, and I ended up having issues with my club. I wanted to leave, and it's very hard to leave, but at the same time I made it a situation where it wasn't that hard for me to leave, where my drug use just got out of control. I was just becoming a loose cannon. So you can imagine about a bunch of bikies that were all considered by society to be loose cannons, and I was a loose cannon amongst the loose cannons. So go figure that one. I got the bashing for it. I lost my Harley Davidson, I lost a car, I lost money that I'd invested. But I walked away with my life. Unfortunately, because I had family involved, I lost my family as well. I lost contact with my children. I have 4 children. Basically I was like a disgrace. So carrying the pain and the burdens that I'd carried from being a soldier, I just indulged more in drugs and drugs and drugs to escape all the hurt and escape reality. I found myself moving up into the hills in Rolling Stone. I bought myself a property up there, and I had a nice two-story house and on an acre block. And I basically took myself out of society, and I lived like a hermit. And the only contact I really had with the outside world was when I'd go shopping once a week, or to have my children over on a weekend. My drug usage just got worse and worse, and cut a long story short, I found myself behind $12,000 in a mortgage. By the time I went to do anything about it, it was too late. The bank said, no, enough's enough, we're taking your property off you. I walked away with bugger all. I found myself just going further and further in the gut. I didn't think I would go any further. Suicide was an option. However, knowing that if I did that, how would it affect my children? I'd already affected them enough in the life that I lived, and I was never really there for them when they were young kids because of my lifestyle, either as a soldier or as a bikie. A life of a bikie is not as glamorous as what people might think. It's 24/7, and you're committed to the brotherhood, so to speak. Anyhow, I found myself homeless, and I found myself living in some barracks in the city, and for me that was, I've been a proud person most of my life, and for me that was detrimental, and again, I just felt low, I felt dirty, you know. Here I was, I was basically living in the gutter. And because of my drug habit, it had left me there, and I felt so unworthy of just anybody or anything. And lo and behold, all of a sudden, the Lord Jesus came into my life, and he's still a progress in my life now. But I found myself all of a sudden in the community of Lockridge, and I met these wonderful people here. And it was almost a year ago to this day. It was the weekend of my 40th. And they didn't know me for a bar of soap. They had no idea who I was. There was another gentleman, Peter DeBlanc, who himself is an ex-soldier, and detained me to the house. They wanted to have an interview and see what I was about. Peter, being an ex-soldier, he said, look, regardless of what this guy's done in his life, he's been a soldier, and to me that says he's trustworthy and he's loyal and he's credible. And these guys have saved my life. I've just gone from destitute to now having a chance in life where people could trust, to put their trust in me. They didn't know me, they didn't have to help me, but they did. And it brought a tear to my eye. I wrote these guys a letter saying it's lovely to, after seeing what I saw as a soldier overseas in the war zone, you just can't possibly imagine that, that the hell that you see, and you start to question the world we live in. Seeing poverty, I was in Somalia, and to have these wonderful people come into my life, it was like, my God, there really are some nice people in the world. Not everyone's bad. And it touched my heart immensely, and they never did anyone ever push anything upon me. It was done in such a wonderful way. There was support for, I was given a mentor. His name's Tom Shackles. I don't know if any of you know him, he's well known. Tom's lovely wife, Lynn. Steve here pretty well helped me to transition into becoming a Christian. He answered my questions when I asked about religion. Because, it's most of my life I'm not a Christian. I just couldn't imagine there being this great Lord, and, now I know better. But, a year later, I was in Ezekiel House for a few months, and I found myself in a community that's wonderful. I never thought I could be, I was the last person I'd ever been to become a Christian. And here I am in this community of Lockridge, and the Lord is at work there, he really is. And these five people behind me, I'm still making the transition, I'm still getting used to, I noticed the song that we were saying before about the Lord carrying our burdens for us, and I'm still finding it hard. I'm still carrying my own burden, I'm still trying to allow the Lord to get a life for him, and it's certainly a rewarding experience so far. To finish off, I just want to say that, in Lockridge here, it's just great what these guys are doing. There's a couple of other folks sitting in the deep of the house trying to make that transition. These guys have helped me. I had some bad debts prior to my, when I was out. All of these guys have helped me through that. I didn't have to do that. And then recently I met Ken here, Ken Maley, through the network, and I've been out of work for a couple of years now. I've been out of license. My license for speeding and stupid things. And, I've been very fortunate. Again, the Lord's at work, because Ken's got a program with his company where he's up to capital and I've been meeting for him. But I found myself now, I've got the opportunity to have a job in a couple of weeks. So my life is still getting better and better. I'm rebuilding, and I'm just so grateful to everyone, to all Christians, and grateful to the Lord. So, thank you.
Thanks, Bill. That was awesome, mate. So we'll just go through. It's hard. The more you've been through, the harder it is to put your heart on the line and say, here I am, warts and all. So really, thank you, Phil. It was great. So highs and lows, Erica, Tanya and Gary, and then I'll give a quick biblical reflection.
I was just thinking that you probably all think we're really, really wonderful, but there's a few more people we could trot out and say some things about us. And I guess that reminds me of some of the lows of some of the people in Ezekiel House not coping so well, and when they got drunk, just screaming and running up and down the street and disturbing us and everyone in the street, and that being really, really difficult to know that, you know, when we're trying to build relationships with neighbours, that we actually brought those people in. And I guess the other bit is that it has cost us an awful lot financially, and I know this for Gary and Tanya as well, because we've been buying and selling at this time of the market. It's set us back a significant amount, and at the moment Neo's really quite, I think you'll get there, but he's quite unhappy with the house that we have and would much prefer to live in our old house. And we've got a house that's fairly crappy in comparison to the house we had before, and he feels that quite keenly, and it's much smaller, and that's difficult. On the plus side, it's got a much bigger yard, and that's what we, you know, that's part of the thing that attracted us to it, is that, you know, we would be able to grow things and raise rabbits, and the kids would get more of an outdoor experience. But sometimes I am concerned for my kids. The other day, I mean, most of the time I feel completely safe and very happy and settled where we are. Sometimes there are some kids in the neighbourhood that scare me. I saw a child who was probably about 8 carrying a sharpened stick with the intention of stabbing another child who was further up the road outside the front of my house. And I thought, I don't want my children to experience the rough end of this place. And while I might, you know, really want to connect with these people and really want to be used by God, I don't want to use my children for that. And I don't want them to be traumatised. I don't want them to be adversely affected by that. And I guess I just have to keep praying and trusting God that it's actually going to be a plus rather than a minus. And I remember praying about that and saying, God, I don't want these kids near my own children. I don't want my children traumatised, and I care about my children, I want to protect them. And he said, I care about my children too, and those kids are as much my kids as yours. And, you know, I wanted to protect my children, but God also wants to protect that particular kid from going further down the track that he's already on. And I guess without people, you know, like us in the community, what hope do they have? I took the opportunity, because I felt very helpless, took the opportunity to go and speak to the dad of the child that they were after, who lives up the road from us, and that was a really positive experience. Out of that has meant that this kid who they were after has come to our house every single day since then. And, you know, you can kind of get a bit tired of the neighbourhood children coming to your house, but it just makes me realise that they are desperately lonely. There's either no one home, or at worst, there are people home, or the environment in their house is something that they just don't want to be around, and they would much rather be at our house with our kids. And the plus side, our kids get to experience a lot of great things that they don't normally experience. They're in touch with a lot of really good value adults, and they have a lot of adult relationships. Our kids learn where food comes from, they get to grow stuff, they get... My son, who's 2, knows what worms and compost are. He gets dirty, he loves walking across the road to Peace Tree following their chickens, and they're very gracious and accommodating to him. They will fill up watering cans for him, and they will taking in wheelbarrows and, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, we collect eggs, we get raw milk and all sorts of things that, you know, we just wouldn't have access to in another lifestyle.
Daniel?
I think my highs and lows, the ones that first come to mind, are centred around kids as well. There's a high is being close in community and having really good relationships with people who are outside of our family, and that's a high. At the same time, that's a struggle. With our number two, there's some behavioural issues, and some of the lows have been continually watching him hurting others in the community, for example, Ben. So that's been really hard to watch and to know what to do. We started off at the local school, and we were there for 2 years, and we really wanted to support and be a part of change in the local school, and it got to a point where we really couldn't do that anymore, and that was a very hard decision, because moving schools is very hard, is a hard thing to do. We have moved to what I consider to be a great school. Michaela's still not happy with her new school. And Gary and I are still very confident that we've done the right thing there, but that's been a very hard thing to actually move. Another high has been, a couple of weeks ago, a lady who suffers from schizophrenia, who was on a day pass from the mental health ward at Swan District. She came to our house on 5 o'clock in the morning one morning, and it was, and to sit there, we didn't know what to do to start off with, but to sit with her and to be with her, I felt was a really privileged position to be in, because there's such, you guys would know, such enormous gaps in terms of caring for people who are mentally unwell. And I think if the Christians aren't going to be there for these people, then who will? Because it's really tricky and really hard and really scary as well at times. So to sit with this woman for a couple of hours, and eventually she was taken away by the police, but it was a safe and comforting time, and afterwards I thought, that is such a privilege to be there. And again, I wouldn't have thought that wouldn't have happened in Helena Valley. So I would say that being involved in experiences of healing, that's the highlight.
I think the lows aren't as low as when you have difficulties with babies and so when we have lows, I never felt like I feel like we've got people around and we're also doing the right thing in God's ways and deal with that. I can't think of any really I can make a lot of this that really hit me about. Highs, there's been a lot of small highs, like I really enjoy going to the Peace Tree and the liturgies, and that they have a liturgies on Friday night church, and they have just general chit chat afterwards, and that's always really good. Really enjoy having Easter with them as well. And read different passages of scripture as a kind of progressive service. We've had some. There's a lot of sort of small gatherings at different times that have happened, and sometimes it's a gospel as well.
Thanks, Gary. Are there any questions that you guys have of us? I know we've taken up time and I will be short in my reflection. Any questions or any last gasp thoughts that you wanted to share?
I was just going to say that there's a whole lot of very simple things that I don't think about because I get so used to it, and that is
convicting waters is for you have to go to the shop and run out of something, and often going somewhere you need a babysitter is not much of an issue either. Sometimes we go to the home and go across the road back and forth, or someone can just come and sit at our house, go across the road while I go out. Often, yeah, so we often are able to use people from the community to care for our kids, to help us drive places, to help us do jobs, to help us with all sorts of things in a way that you kind of forget after you've been doing it for a while that you're able to share it. You make too much of something, then you give it to someone else who's at the road or wherever you do. There's a lot of constant sharing that you begin with.
That's been a major point for us. It's not just that we've got people available who we need and even at short notice. It's also that you get random drop-ins that just break up the routine and also ground through.
Any questions?
Yeah, Steve.
Yeah. Most of us try to work as local as possible
and as little
as possible to sustain our mortgages or whatever we need to do. So we try to make an effort to free up time to be in the community and to be around as much as possible. Is that fair enough?
And we tend to work together when we can too. And Lynn Shackles works at Governor Stirling, and Tanya and I also work with her. Whenever we can, if we have jobs that we need doing, we employ people in their community. Phil does a lot of our jobs for us, doing our gutters at the moment. We have someone who lives in another house of ours who struggles to pay the rent, so we get her to clean for us in exchange for the rent that she can't afford. There's also lots of groups of kids around who love getting paid odd jobs to do, so we'll get them to do things around the garden and the house for us. So as much as we can, we try to be local and assured as time as possible. We have done a number of activities where we've looked at our finances and how we spend our time as Open Table, and we are accountable to each other in that. And I remember when I started working a couple of days, Tom Shuckle said to me, "And what are you going to take away with these 15 hours? Where are you going to find it, and what are you giving up?" And that was a really quite a confronting question. I had to look seriously at what I was doing and what I was giving up, and whether that fitted with our values.
I'm working in a standard
white collar
job, but contract in the Netherlands.
Any other question? One last highlight from me is we had a house full of a refugee house for 6 months last year. To see Phil connect with these guys and to be changed by them and say, you know, I need to rethink. I want to do something, somehow spread the word and help people understand the plight of asylum seekers. That for me was fantastic, because I wasn't part of it, and it just happened. And to see that sort of stuff happen is very exciting. Thank you, Lockridge Open Table. You can have a seat. Feel free to ask us questions later if you want to. I know it's 11. I just wanted to give a very short... Put this down. Keep the mic. This is a very munted version of what I was going to say. So here we go. For me, the fact that we live in that we are very rich... motivates me, because I think most of the Bible You've heard from Dave Andrews last week when he Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, that Jesus was saying, blessed are those who stand in solidarity with the poor. And what does that, I mean, how does that work when we are, if we've got a computer connected to the internet, we're in the top 4% of the world's richest people, that in this stage of history we're the richest generation that has ever lived, that we're rich probably because other people are poor, that we drink the coffee that Brazilians grow, that we buy the shirts made from China at a cheap rate. So how can we somehow, even locally, stand in solidarity with the poor? And because to understand the poor means to understand Jesus and connect with him. And so one of the thoughts that Martin Luther King said is, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And if you flip that, it's basically saying, well, justice can have a ripple effect, effect everywhere if you start where you are. So creating communities that keep each other accountable, that try and reconnect, relocalise, connect with marginalised people and speak out against what's bad in the world, for me it's like short-circuiting the principalities and powers that the Bible talks about. It's reconfiguring society as a taste of heaven on earth. I remember Erica's brother-in-law came to the Community Garden Pizza Day and he said to me, this is amazing. This is fantastic. You're telling me all these people come from the local community? I said, well, yeah, most of them. He said, you know, this is the way life should be, shouldn't it? I said, yeah. He said, you know, I don't connect with my neighbours, and I should, but I don't connect with them because when I do, they keep talking to me and I don't have the time. He said, but that's wrong, isn't it? I said, yeah. He said, I'm going to go back, now that I've experienced this, and go back and try and reconnect with my neighbours. I said, that's great. I said, you know, that, for me, that's a Jesus thing. That's something that Jesus would do. That's in my language. And he took that. So for me, all powers, principalities and powers, all rulers and authorities, from, if you read Colossians 1, they're in need of redemption. When Jesus got crucified, it's interesting to see how many principalities and powers, how many rulers, how many organisations, how many different levels of society there were in killing him. The spiritual, Judas, Satan entered Judas, the, you know, Herod and Pilate and backwards and forwards, the religious leaders conspired. So government levels at state and federal levels. And then he had a public opinion poll, and then the consequences of Jesus' death was that there were environmental consequences. There was a solar eclipse, there was an earthquake. So on all of these levels, in Colossians 1 verse 19 it says, all things were made by him and for him. So all levels of government and society, all big business, BHB, Bilton, Monsanto, Nestle, whoever it is, was made by God. But they've been corrupted and they've been bent to serve mammon and evil and bad, sometimes bad decisions have been made. But that gives me hope to believe that they can also be redeemed. They can also be brought back under the authority of Christ. And someone once said that the best critique of the bad is the practice of the better. So in modelling a local, modelling a better way in local communities, we can subvert a lot of the powers that, a lot of the bad decisions that are made in, upstairs. I'll just say, for example, with money, just take money for example, you can either save it, spend it, or give it. What we tend to do is we tend to ask big questions when we give. Who's the money going to? Is it going to the right place? Is it, you know, are they going to do with it what they said they'd do. And it's right and good to ask those questions. But we don't realise that in terms of us saving and spending, that millions of dollars are going to go through our bank account in our lifetime. And the purchases that we make have a whole range of implications about how those products were made, how were people treated in the process of those products. So if you can grow your own food, then that saves the carbon miles, you know, amazing amount of carbon miles. And if we can live sustainably, we don't have to oppress other people in our across the world. And for every ethical and purchase that you make, you create the world of tomorrow. Buying a particular product above others, it has implicit decisions about how the workers were treated. Beginning to wrap up, it's interesting to note that when Jesus was crucified, it follows the same pattern as how a Caesar was inaugurated. So it mimics the inauguration of Caesar. So the Romans had him stand up in the middle of the Praetorium. They put a purple robe on him, put a crown on his head and a scepter in his hands. They led him down a procession to the capital, to the head hill. And they offered him wine and he went to drink it, but he didn't. And lastly, some sign that the Roman gods thought this was the next son of God, because that's what Caesars were called. They had a flock of doves released, or some amazing sign in the skies like a solar eclipse. And for me, that signifies that what Jesus is saying is Caesar is not king. I am king. And I'm, you know, how does that translate into our communities? If Jesus is king, then economic growth and our pursuit of that is not king. If Jesus is king, then national security and border protection is not king. If Jesus is king, then putting my family first and my happiness and my security and my reputation is not king. And so that's why we try to figure out, the task of us is to try to figure out how do we do that in our local communities. How do we disarm the principalities and powers and reduce our working hours so that we have time to connect and engage locally? Very lastly, I hope I haven't said this before, but it was a revelation to me that the last reference to Jesus in the Bible is that he is the star of the morning, that he is Venus. Venus is the star of the morning, and it comes up at the height of the night when it's at its blackest, but from then on it begins to get light. So it's as if Jesus is saying, I am pulling the darkness into, I'm absorbing it into myself, and I'm pulling the day ahead. And for me, it's to act as if, for us, it's in Lockridge, how can we act as if God's kingdom is already here? That if there is no housing problem, there is no, that people are treated ethically and that we can love our neighbours. And for me, it's about waiting while this system is going to fall apart, because it's unsustainable as it is. How can we plant mustard seeds of God's kingdom, his revolution of justice and love, and begin to disarm the powers? That's partly my take on why we do what we do. Let's pray and let's call it quits. Beautiful. Dear Lord, thank you again for this time together to regroup and to huddle and to figure out, keep on track, why we do what we do. I pray that somehow what we've said may we'd be able to figure out for us in our communities, in our situations, in our lives, what's the next step for us in our relationship with you, to challenge us and provoke us to help bring your kingdom to come. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve.